From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. In a moment, Chasing UFOs with James Fox. And later tonight, will SETI ever make contact with other life forms? Here's what's happening. Very tense situation in Colorado tonight. A towering wildfire, jumping firefighters' perimeter lines, moving into the city of Colorado Springs now, forcing frantic evacuation orders for more than 35,000 residents. That number grows, and destroying an unknown number of homes. The fire doubled in size overnight to now more than 24 square miles. It's huge. Holly Dale with us, graduated from the University of Missouri in Kansas City. She, of course, with her husband Stan, experts on how to prepare, her book, Dare to Prepare. Holly's with us now. Holly, I can't think of a fire any worse than this one in Colorado right now. How about you?
Absolutely. We still have the Hyde Park fire up in Colorado Springs, up in Fort Collins. That's a bigger fire, but this one is certainly much more catastrophic. The words are used, George, just can't convey the devastation here. Historic, unprecedented, never before seen, catastrophic fury. And last night when we watched the news broadcasters, these people were choking back tears because the local news originates there in Colorado Springs, and some of the people that were actually on air last night didn't know if they would have a home to go home to.
Three of the firefighters that were fighting in Georgia, their homes were destroyed last night as well. And we have about 1,000 people fighting the fires at the moment, more coming in.
Stan and Holly, with this situation, I mean, what's really causing all of this? Does this have anything to do with the intense heat? I mean, in St. Louis, for example, this week, they're predicting temperatures over 100 degrees. It's unheard of.
Well, yes. Colorado Springs, where these fires are, the worst ones, have had the highest temperatures ever on record. And the moisture here is absent. We've had only like half of the amount of rain we should be having, and combine that with low humidity and then gusty winds, it's just the makings for disaster, which we have seen. Yesterday, they started talking about how in the world did this happen? How could this have happened here? It started on Saturday just as a single small column of fire, though there have been reports, people, a few of them had said they thought they smelled smoke Friday night. But they sent people up on the ridge, and nothing was found. So at noon, this is when they first discovered this fire on Saturday, and then it just exploded. And now it's at 18,500 acres, and they have 36,000 people that have been evacuated. Out of Colorado Springs proper, they have 32,500 gone. And then from the unincorporated areas out of the city there, but also still in the harm's way, they have almost 3,500 people. And
all right,
there are many more what they call preliminary evacuations, which means you have to go or be ready to go. Then the mandatory evacuation, you must go.
Yeah.
We are going to keep our fingers crossed and some prayers for everybody in that area. Holly and Stan Dale, thank you so much. Their website, of course, standale.com. All of that linked up at our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Debbie was expected to head out into the Atlantic, but forecasters warn that this tropical storm has weakened, but it still poses a flooding and tornado threat, even if it doesn't pack the same punch. We are in hurricane season right now. Smokers could one day be immunized against nicotine, so they gain no pleasure from the habit of smoking. According to researchers here in the United States, they have devised a vaccine that floods the body with an antibody to assault nicotine entering the body. The House Oversight Committee has voted to demand a broad audit of the Federal Reserve System by congressional investigators, a move that lawmakers said is designed to bring accountability to the murky workings of the independent central bank. The bill was sponsored by Representative Ron Paul, who turned the push for an audit into a very powerful presidential campaign slogan, and whose criticism of the Fed's monetary policy drew hundreds of thousands of voters into the political process. G. Edward Griffin, author of the book and DVD Creature from Jekyll Island about the Federal Reserve. G. Edward Griffin, what do you think? Does this thing have any teeth?
You mean this proposal to audit the Fed?
Yep.
Well, sure, it has teeth, but don't forget, the Fed has teeth, too. And we know that the, it has a lot of influence in Congress. And every time that Ron Paul or anybody else has started to move in the direction of auditing the Fed, it seems like at the last minute, the Federal Reserve sends its representatives around, and they start talking to the congressmen and the senators one by one. And then miraculously at the last minute, these fellows lose interest in any kind of a proposal. But nevertheless, I think that today, with so much more interest at the public level, that it's harder and harder to divert that thrust. As for my opinion, I've always thought that we didn't need to audit the Fed as much as we needed to abolish the Fed. I've often felt that there was kind of a mamby-pamby approach. But now that we've seen that a semi-audit, if you want to call it that, a limited audit, has already produced some amazing revelations about the Federal Reserve giving away billions of dollars to European banks, I think I've kind of changed my mind. I think an audit of the Fed, if it didn't take too long, if it didn't drag out for months and years, I think it'd be a very revealing thing, especially because it would then help to further and strengthen the movement eventually to abolish the Fed.
Good point, Edward, and I hope this all happens. I really do. You know, two-thirds of the respondents to a new survey say that President Barack Obama would be better suited to handle an alien invasion than Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney. They basically said this as part of a National Geographic survey conducting this for its series, Chasing UFOs. And we'll be talking to one of those who chases UFOs, James Fox and Colonel John Alexander, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. As you just heard, the National Geographic coming out with a series called Chasing UFOs. And, of course, James Fox, for nearly 20 years, traveled across the world in pursuit of the truth regarding UFOs. He is with us right now on Coast to Coast. Colonel John Alexander is going to join us in a few seconds as well. James, welcome back. Always a pleasure.
Really great to be on your show, George.
This is exciting stuff. I saw a promo for it tonight on television, and here it is. And of course, just heard their message here on our program as well. Tell us a little bit about this.
I was just listening to the promo on the radio station as well, and I was like, I got to see that.
Yeah, you will.
Well, you know, it's amazing. As someone who's been an independent filmmaker on the subject for quite some time, I've produced three films on it prior to this opportunity. It's a boon in some respects to have the opportunity of a massive organization like National Geographic behind you with the whole infrastructure and the financing and that sort of thing. So in that regard, it's truly phenomenal. Is it exactly the platform that I'm used to doing research and delivering UFO information? No, it's not. You can say my independent films, but it's a great opportunity to try my darndest to focus on the most solid cases, the most solid evidence, the most solid witnesses that, you know, that we can find from around the world. And having National Geographic behind us in doing that is just amazing.
All right, we've got lots to talk with you about tonight, James. But let's bring back and in Colonel John Alexander, of course, noted researcher and author as well, a leading advocate for the development of non-lethal weaponry. But he's also been an expert in the pursuit of the truth, the UFOs. And we're going to talk with him as well about the Stevensville, Texas case, what's going on with the old Phoenix Lights case that happened in 1997. John, welcome back. How are you?
Well, great. Glad to be here, George.
Likewise. I'm looking forward to, as I was telling Jim about chasing UFOs, it's just good that networks will start doing a serious job about this. You, John, of course, you've been a no-nonsense guy all your life. What's going on with you these days?
Well, more no-nonsense. We're working on a number of projects. I got the call on this particular one. James is the guy who contacted me and asked if I had come down and filmed, and you'll see me in the first episode that has to do with Texas and particularly the Stevensville case that you mentioned.
I'd like to call you a cautious skeptic, John, because I think you believe, but you want proof. Is that pretty accurate?
Well, he just believes.
Well, I, you know, first line of my book is UFOs are real, so I have no doubt about that.
Right.
I do question what they are, and I think we've got whatever it is. It's just terribly, terribly complex.
John and I had a very spirited debate that, unfortunately, I think the majority of it ended up on the edit room floor, but about the lack of cover-up or the so-called lack of cover-up, because I strongly disagree with that position.
How so, James? Tell me.
Well, he was saying that, you know, UFOs are real, and we are on the same page on that one.
Right.
And don't get me wrong, I really respect Colonel Alexander tremendously, but having met with the people I've met with who personally told me they handed evidence over to some unknown government agency, never to be seen or heard from again, that to me is a cover-up. And it's tangible evidence, according to their testimony, that would strongly support the UFO phenomenon, the existence of UFOs.
John, you're familiar with, of course, the Phoenix Lights case. And what about Stephensville, Texas? Do you see a comparison here?
Well, I think there's a huge comparison. That's almost a pun. Part of it is the size of the object that was seen. Another has to do with the number of lights that were seen, the number of people. One of the things I saw in the show, I've actually seen it, that I found that was really fascinating, is a guy who shows up with a video that he had taken and shows it to James and the crew, and it looks strikingly like what we saw in Lynn Katai's tapes from Phoenix Lights.
Well, that's true. And James, of course, the first episode centered in Texas, presenting a lot of information about this case.
Can I share something with you guys that I know didn't, some of which did and is ended up in the episode, but one of the things that was incredible for me, Colonel, you'll get a kick out of this, speaking of the fact there's no cover-up, is that right after I was at the old grist mill, we were doing an interview with Ricky Sorrells. He was the hunter, the deer hunter that stood directly under the craft that was so big. He couldn't see the edge of this thing in any direction. And he's a metal worker, so he was slowly analyzing the belly of this thing and describing what the texture was like and these little sort of inverted cones in the belly of the craft. And that when it took off, it accelerated so quickly that had he blinked, he would have thought it just disappeared. Right after the interview, which is a phenomenal interview because it's very, you know, few witnesses that I certainly have met with that are that close and personal to a UFO. Do you know what I mean? They can actually study the texture and the metal of the craft. Well, right after the interview, I was walking away from Ricky Sorrells. This gentleman walked up to me and pulled out a badge, and he showed me his police officer badge. And he said, "My name is Officer X. I'd like to talk with you."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was kind of a jolt. I said, "Okay," and I kind of looked around at some production people I was with. I said, "Hey, guys, I got to take a walk. I'll be back." We went into a coffee shop. We sat down, and he kind of sort of paranoidly looked around over both shoulders to see if anyone was listening, and he said, "I saw that same craft that Ricky Sorrell saw. I want you to know that I was on duty that night."
James, how did everybody key in on Texas first?
In terms of like, what? In terms of the reception of
the show, with regards to the show, why did they pick that as the first one?
There were some really open minds, had some really good footage, or possibly some really good footage of a UFO in the Texas area. I made reference to a UFO crash, alleged crash back, it was dating back to 1891 at the old grist mill, which was like 6 years earlier than the Aurora, Texas 1897 crash. And it made it to the front page of the Dublin Progress about, you know, of course, there weren't really anything flying around in the sky that time, so the witness had a difficult time to describe what it was. But we were finding parallels in Texas. We were finding parallels with other cases. So we wanted to go back and revisit Dublin, Stephenville area, talk about some other cases in Texas, as well as, obviously, you can't go to Stephenville and not talk about Stephenville, you know, UFO reported. But we investigated other things while we were there as well.
And John, when you were on with me a little more than a month ago, you were telling me that you were sending letters to senior defense and intelligence officials about your work. Did you send that, and did you get any kind of response?
Well, I did send letters to the head of CIA, the director of national intelligence, and to Panetta as the secretary of defense. The only one I heard back from was CIA, and I just responded to them today because what they said was, "We've interpreted this to be a FOIA request." In other words, Freedom of Information request for information. And my response was, "That's just bureaucratic crap. You know, obviously, there was nothing in my letter that said, I'm looking for new information. It was, why don't you do something about this?
Well, it sounds like a cover-up to me, John.
I don't think it's
I'm kidding. Let me very quickly finish my story. So the officer took me aside. He told me about this incredible encounter, that the object was so close, he hit it with his radar gun, clocked it at 22 miles an hour. Footage from other officers that night of the craft was taken by the local Air Force base, never to be seen or heard from again. But it's very interesting that he didn't want his name used. He didn't want any notoriety. The cameras weren't rolling for an officer with a badge to pull me aside to tell me that story. Phenomenal, that is, right?
It's a great story. I mean, Linda Moulton Howitt talked to a constable out that way. And, I mean, it really had some incredible witnesses to it. I think it's a strong, strong case. I mean, but, John, when you get these cases like this, I mean, you want more evidence than even what they're finding for UFO chasing UFOs.
Oh, not necessarily, but, you know, I think what James hit on is very key. The officer that he talks about, my take would be they just don't want to be embarrassed. And, you know, there's quite a stigma attached with reporting UFOs. Remember, my shtick in this is that I think we need to make it permissible for senior scientists and all to get involved in studying it without risking their reputation. But that stigma is definitely there.
Okay, well, yeah, I totally agree with you on that as well, Colonel. But the one thing that I'd like to point out is that if the military, the local military base, confiscated or requested that footage from the police department and that footage was conclusive of a massive flying unknown object, don't you think that would help strengthen the case that that really happened? And if that evidence is lacking, well, then it's sort of a cover-up?
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, there's no evidence that says the government did, in fact, take it, I think.
Well, I'm just telling you what the police officer told me, but that's just one in, you know, thousands of cases.
You're trying to argue with him again, James, aren't you?
Well, my point being is that if a military officer hands over conclusive evidence that, you know, that supports the fact that UFOs, that to me is a cover-up.
All right, well, John is with us, I want to thank you, John, Colonel John Alexander, who was on with me a month ago talking about Roswell and some incredible work that he's been doing. James, of course, you're going to continue with us for a couple hours, and we've got a special guest coming in with you in just about 10 minutes or so. So this evolution of chasing UFOs, was it difficult to convince the network National Geographic, let's do something like this?
Well, what was, you know, some of the international stuff I fought for. And, you know, there's Ben McGee, who's the scientist, and we can talk a little bit about him later, and then also Aaron Ryder, who is our co-host as well as the co-executive producer. So I had a lot of ideas, but I had to run all these ideas by everybody, and then it had to fit within a certain structure within the show's program. So while a lot of the cases I was pushing hard for, especially the international stuff, like, for instance, Virginia, Brazil, 1996 case, some of the stuff that goes down in Mexico. But what was really cool about this is that suddenly, you know, for the first time ever, we had the resources to revisit older cases and subject to scientific analysis and that sort of thing. And I'd never had that before, so that was really, really exciting. It's like, all right, well, how can we go back to the Travis Walton case, and what can we do that hasn't been done? Or, for instance, going to Brazil, or going to a reenactment of the famous case over Campeche, Mexico, that Jaime Maussan had the footage from the Air Force. So all these things we got to redo, we got to revisit some of the new cases as well, and that was just incredible to have that level of resources and support behind us was unlike anything I've ever experienced.
Since Larry King retired, and James, you were with me on one of his shows, and you've been on his shows many times, the networks have lost this ability, I think, to do some quality work with UFOs. So this is one of the first times since King retired that any network has done anything serious about this, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting, too, because, you know, every time we did any of those CNN shows, the network said it rated unbelievably well. There's a massive interest, and it's the kind of thing that transcends politics and religion and borders. Everyone's kind of fascinated whether they believe in it or not, and it's surprising to me. I don't know. It seems to sort of come in waves, and, you know, with Chasing UFOs, it's a very exciting opportunity. Obviously, one only hopes that it does well and that we could, you know, we can fine-tune the balance in the show to, you know, something that's entertaining yet informative. And I think we're getting very close to that. Certainly, I'm seeing the progression of episodes. I'm really, really enjoying the show.
So, well, the way CNN's ratings have been lately, maybe they need to do more UFO-type shows, James. Huh?
Don't you think?
Oh, my gosh. Stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. Travis Walton is going to join us. Fire in the Sky. James Fox with us for the 2 hours here. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, James Fox with us here. James, as we bring in Travis in a second here, you have had incredible documentary work over the years with your field of UFO research. How did you get started in this in the first place? How did this all happen for you?
I knew you were going to ask me that question.
It's one I never asked you.
I know you haven't, actually. Well, it's funny. I actually had a mainstream father for a journalist who was a quadriplegic with multiple sclerosis, and I was sort of his legs and his chauffeur and his nurse over the years when he would write for different organizations, from Car and Driver to Sports Illustrated, Playboy, and not the nudie section. And I had an interest in UFOs, and I don't need to go into details about how that started, but because I don't want to take up too much time. But I decided to make a documentary on the subject, and I told my father about it, and he was desperately trying to, talk me out of it. He's going, you're going down a dead-end road, and please reconsider. As a matter of fact, he had friends and family from around, write me letters and make phone calls, and that sort of propelled me even further, And so I said, the heck with all you guys. I'm going to do it, regardless. I think I actually made the point even more so because I was sort of rebellious
about
the whole thing. And I produced and sold my first film. I think it took me about 5 years to Discovery Channel, actually broadcast on the Learning Channel. And I never had an intention to do another show on UFOs. And so, long story short, I ended up getting invited to go to Russia because of the result of that film. And then I got an interview with Mercury astronaut Gordon Cooper. And I thought, well, mm-hmm. I guess I'm doing another film here. So I did Out of the Blue. And then I really said I was done. And that was in 2002, 2003. And I was working on other projects, alternative energy, that sort of thing. And then in 2006, I hope I'm not boring everyone to death.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay. In 2006, I got a letter from NBC Universal, who bought Out of the Blue, and they were on Sci-Fi. And they said, we have no plans to, reinstate our broadcast option. So I thought, well, hey, I own the film again. And I fell short on a few of my objectives in 2003. Perhaps I'll revisit the film and just sort of revamp it a bit. And I drafted up a few things, and one of the things was to get an interview with Fife Symington, governor, Arizona governor, and President Bill Clinton, and a couple of other witnesses from Reynolds and Forrest, that sort of thing. And then I broke the Fife Symington story, and that was a rather big story. And that led to I Know What I Saw, and I'm giving you the truncated version. And then I Know What I Saw was, came out a couple of years later, which was a ridiculous amount of work and borrowed money. And then I really said I was done with UFOs after that.
And it's then I in your blood.
By the people at National Geographic to do this thing, and I thought, God, that's a good opportunity. I should do that.
Well, good for you. And, of course, the Fife Symington story was great because he was the governor at the time of Arizona during the Phoenix Lights, made fun of it, had an alien there during a news conference, and then years later basically apologized, recanted, said he made a mistake. And I remember, James, you had him on with Larry King, and I was there with you, and he was talking about that. I thought that was an incredible story, the fact that a governor of a state would make fun of this whole thing that had happened in 1997 and then apologize and say he was wrong about it.
Well, it's funny, actually, because when the interview was happening, he never had any intentions in 2006. He never had any intentions to release what he did with me on camera there. And when it happened, when he said what he said, the fact that not only did he investigate it and get nowhere, talk to the local Air Force Base, Luke Air Force Base, and the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, they all sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, we don't know where that thing came from. But then he admitted to having seen it himself.
That's right.
And that was a game changer. And I remember when it happened, and you hear these stories like I had to pinch myself. I literally was pinching myself because I thought I must be dreaming right now. I'm not kidding you. I really was. I was pinching my arm, and then I thought, well, let me make gosh darn sure that this camera is recording the statement right now. So I remember going down in the middle of the interview and looking down to the viewfinder of the camera and making sure that the record light was on. Because I had a feeling it was going to be kind of big, but my life's never been the same ever since.
It's been huge. And, of course, talking about Arizona, back in 1975, a group of loggers in the mountains there in Arizona saw a very strange, unusually bright light in the sky. One of those men, Travis Walton, left the safety of his truck. He wanted to take a closer look. And when Travis failed to reappear, the men, his friends, were suspected of murder. For 5 days, the authorities mounted a massive manhunt in search of Walton, and Walton eventually reappeared. He was disoriented. He was unable, really, initially, to tell the details of his encounter, and his book, Fire in the Sky, provides an account of this experience turned into a movie. Here's Travis Walton back on Coast to Coast. Travis, always a pleasure. How are you?
Good to be with you, George, James.
I got to tell you, every event I go to, people bring up your name, Travis. They talk about you with such high regard and respect and credibility. It's truly an honor to have you back on the program.
It's an honor to know Travis Walton. I am so privileged to even know you, Travis, and I consider you one of the best witnesses alive today. And one of the things I wanted to quickly mention is that Tracy Torme found out that I was going to be on the show tonight, and he said, please send my regards to both George and to Travis. He's the one that did Fire in the Sky with you.
Super. Super. Travis, since 1975 to this point, what has your life been like because of this episode?
Well, you know, public reaction to it has kind of evolved, but, you know, my own, participation, so to speak, in talking about it has been off and on at times. You know, there's been long stretches where I just, you know, quit talking about it for a while.
And then here you are back again. And just so everybody knows, and many are familiar with your case, but you and your friends at the time all passed lie detector tests. Is that correct?
Yeah. But now the number of passed tests in regard to this incident is up to 16. I've taken and passed 5 different tests from 3 different examiners. So it's been thoroughly investigated in that regard.
I had the opportunity to meet John Goulet when we were just recently in Arizona with you, Travis, and that was one of the other witnesses. Obviously, there were 7 in total, 6 besides Travis. But John Goulet remembered it like it was yesterday.
Yeah,
and I would guess everybody's life has been changed because of this episode. And James, Chasing UFOs, of course, very interested in the Travis Walton story.
Oh, my gosh. I was jumping up and down going, we got to do Travis. And I contacted Travis, you know, and it's just like such an honor to have the opportunity to work with Travis on this case. And, you know, hey, what hasn't been done that you'd like to see done? And he talked about, I should actually hand it over to Travis and let you describe it, Travis, because I was floored.
Well, you know, it's mutual. It was great, you know, with your track record and everything to finally get somebody, interested in covering these things. I'd been interested in some time in revisiting the site and kind of, going back and, you know, rechecking some of the readings and measurements that were done at the site, and because no one had really followed up on that after all those years.
Was it strange for you, Travis, to go back to the site?
I go back there as little as possible, but it's always, you know, has a huge impact on me.
Oh, and Travis was saying, you know, look, James, we can't go there. I think it was in January. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
And Travis going, gosh, you know, the accessibility is very limited. I mean, we're talking extremely remote and dead of winter, snow everywhere. And, you know, I think, Travis, you were extremely, I wouldn't say reluctant, but doubtful that we could get there.
Yeah, it was, it would require some really special equipment, and that's what wound up doing, because
there was only one vehicle
for several days to get there with ordinary four-wheel drives and such, and we just got stuck over and over.
Yeah, we ended up getting a search and rescue truck, and we somehow talked them into taking us up there. And it was incredible. Wasn't it like it looked like an old 40s truck with like 3 sets of wheels in the rear, all of which had chains, and it was all-wheel drive.
Military surplus 10-wheel drive vehicle.
Oh, man, it was incredible. And we just like, you know, worked our way up into the mountains, and we're talking remote.
Yeah. And even machine kind of got stuck a time or two, but not for long.
You got to the spot, though, right?
Oh, yeah. We got to the exact location, and we actually took, do you mind if I say this, Travis?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we actually took tree core samples from Ground Zero with Travis there. And you know, Travis was saying, look, you know, I'm seeing like some anomalous, you know, tree growth, sort of inexplicable accelerated tree growth patterns from the rings. And you know, Travis is the expert because he's, you know, he's worked with trees for forever.
I'm not. I'm only going with what Travis said. But we, so we took some tree core samples, and we saw these, you know, you see the tree rings, and each tree ring represents, correct me if I'm wrong, a year of tree growth.
Yeah.
And for the first however many years it is of that life of that tree. And then suddenly, right around the time of the incident, the tree rings triple, quadruple in growth rate. I mean,
yeah, it's, huge jump.
Huge jump. You can't even believe how obvious it is. Now, whether or not that's directly correlated or not, it certainly appears to be, is up for, you know, speculation. But it was absolutely phenomenal to see that.
Well, Travis and James, do you know that since the episode of 75, did government go out there and do any testing, or did any scientists go back out there, or do we not even know that?
Travis?
Well, I talked to a local reporter who was a volunteer at one of the local fire towers a short distance from there, and she said that following summer that a group of government researchers came through and they were making magnetic readings on the ground. So I kind of wondered if that wasn't some kind of a follow-up on those magnetic readings that the UFO researchers found right at the site, because they said they found a really large fluctuation across the clearing with an actual polarity reversal.
Gosh, it's hard to believe, Travis. It's been 36, 37 years since this all happened to you.
Yeah, it's incredible. And, you know, it's amazing how new information is still coming out, and the interest slowly built over the years to where, you know, I kind of just came out of retirement and decided to reissue the book and start talking about it again, because the interest was coming from all over the world.
Oh, yeah. It's a huge story. It's one of the best, I think, James and Travis, in our era, it's one of the best UFO abductee cases I've ever seen.
Absolutely, without a shadow of doubt. Like, if I had to put my life on the line saying happened or didn't happen, one or the other, I'd say I put my life on the line that it happened as you guys reported it to happen, especially after having met with, you know, John Goulet, and listen to the testimony of the other witnesses and the fact they all passed lie detector tests. And here we are 36 plus years later, and your story has gotten, you know, maintained exactly the same story as you've always had 36 years later. I mean, with everything to lose and nothing to gain.
And yeah, Travis,
people really need to remember, everything to lose, nothing to
nothing
gain.
Nothing to gain. Travis, over the years, I'm sure you have been rattling your head saying, why did they do this to me? What did they want? Have you come up with a conclusion why
you think
they did this?
You know, my interpretation of events has kind of evolved. You know, right after it happened, I just felt really violated. I went along with the terminology abduction. But in more recent years, I'm putting it together that, you know, perhaps it was more of an ambulance call than an abduction. You know, I caused an energy pulse to jump from that craft to through me to the ground by getting too close suddenly like that. And I think that it probably, you know, did some serious damage, you know, maybe cardiac arrest or something like that. And there was no choice on their part but to take me and try to fix things.
Good point. Do you think, had you not jumped out of the truck to go by this craft, if that's what it was, that they never would have taken you?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, you know. So, you know, when the other guys in the truck blame me, saying, you know, if you hadn't got out of the truck, this wouldn't be happening. I you know, I have to admit that's probably true. You know, it was just kind of an impulse that I regret acting on.
Travis, one of the things that you shared with me at the site, which I found incredible, was that when they returned you 5 days later, they didn't do it at the same site. Because had they done that, you probably would have died.
Yeah, that would have been way
you
back
in some valley on the outskirts
from hell.
Town.
To a point where they knew he could get back to civilization,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. But they did it in the area, Travis helped me explain this, but wasn't it in a valley somewhere where they kind of discreetly dropped down in a valley and minimized their exposure?
Yeah, the canyon walls would have hidden them much better, taking me there than, you know, say, like this big valley that I live in, the Snowflake Valley, this big wide valley. You know, hundreds of people would have seen them had they done it in town here.
Isn't that fascinating, George?
Oh, the whole thing is they were probably, James, looking down at Travis when he jumped out of the truck saying, what is this earthling doing? You know, And then bang, zap, it happens, and they're stuck with him.
Well, they're probably drawing straws as to go get him, you know?
Yeah. What are we going to do with this guy?
What are we going to do with this guy?
Oh, my gosh. But now, the Chasing UFOs, eight parts, is Travis one whole part of that, one of the whole segments?
Probably got a bigger segment in the Arizona episode than anybody else, just because it's such an incredible story. And we went through great effort to get out to the location and Jeeps and bringing him. And so I would say he's a very large portion of the Arizona, which is a full segment, but he's not the whole episode.
Travis, in retrospect, do you wish this never had happened to you?
Well, yeah, you know, I really, you know, I felt that way very strongly for a long period of time. But, I've just come to accept that, you know, what happened happened. I've got to live with it. And now, you know, along with the burden, I've come to realize that, you know, there's a certain responsibility that comes with it. And, you know, so I'm hoping that, you know, by talking about it again, I can, make something good come of it.
The fact that you know in your heart that there are extraterrestrials out there somewhere.
I'm certain.
Has that changed you spiritually? Has it changed your belief in God or a divine intelligence or anything like that?
No. You know, I think people are placing limitations on God to think that, acknowledging the vastness of what's out there and of creation and all that, selling God short. You know, it's just a lot bigger than people figure it to be.
You know, one of the things that left an indelible impression on me, Travis, is when we had dinner together the night before, when I really want to learn something or memorize something, I'll close my eyes and I'll just listen very carefully, and you describe the whole incident to me, and I remember like a film strip in my mind. But then you said to me something. You said, James, do you know what it's like to go through life with hearing all this different speculation and conjecture on something, and you know in your heart that it's true? Do you know what that's like, having that confirmation and others don't? And that really struck a chord with me because, wow, I don't know what that's like. You do.
Yeah, it really is a kind of makes you into an outsider in a certain sense.
But James, it's like a soldier who might come back from Iraq or Afghanistan or World War II talking about the horrors of war, and those of us who have never seen that kind of action, we really don't know what they went through, do we?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. But I'd really admire, Travis's, because Travis could have taken the easy road. He could have just shut everybody out and said, look, I'm not going to talk about this. It's going to be perceived as crazy, and I'm just going to shut it out of my life and treat it like a non-event. But you faced it head on and said, I don't care about the ridicule. I don't care about the making fun of and all the rest of it, and I'm going to stick to my guns, and the others are going to stick to their guns, and this is the truth. Like it or not, believe it or not, this is what happened. And I really respect you for that, and I respect all the others for that, too, because I know it ain't easy.
Applaud you, Travis.
I was tempted to clam up, and one of the crew members was actually and attempted to bribe him to deny it, and he was tempted, but in the end, what happened happened.
Travis, thanks again for being on the program. Good luck on the Chasing UFO series. That's Travis Walton, and of course his work, Fire in the Sky. It's an incredible story of what happened to him. We're coming back in a moment with James Fox. We're going to continue talking with him about his work in the field of ufology, and we'll take your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.